Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on the nature of consciousness and life continuum as revealed through near death, out of body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences. Some of the topics include what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature a stellar roster of special guests with those experiences and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. For more information about our organization Toward the Light on this radio program, please do visit our websites, towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info. I apologize for the technical difficulty we're having. And anyway, we're going to have a wonderful show, I assure you, today. My special guest is Mr. Chris Everard, who's a producer of tremendous documentary films, one of which is entitled Spirit World, and another one that he produced, which is called Secret Space, and then also an Illuminati series that he's produced. So let us welcome to Toward the Light, Mr. Chris Everard. Hello, Chris, and welcome to Toward the Light.
Hello. Thank you very much.
It's wonderful to have you. Chris, will you tell us when you first became interested in the spirit world? And, of course, I'm not talking about your film just yet, but in the spirit world in general. I take it that that happened actually started with childhood. Am I right about that?
Yes, I was about 12 years old when I first witnessed and took part in a session of Ouija, using the Ouija board. And looking back on it now, I think it was very irresponsible of the adults there to allow young children to even see a Ouija session happening. But it fascinated me, and it proved to me over a period of two or three sessions that the spirit world really does exist. And since I've been about 12, 13 years old, I've been interested in spirit communication, psychics, clairvoyance, and that kind of thing, and that's what inspired me to make my film.
Now, I noticed also that when you were, I really enjoyed watching the film, and I noticed that towards the end, there was an interview with you, and you were talking about a very interesting experience you had at the age of two, I believe. It was on your birthday.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'd seen, you know, what I suppose most people would describe as ghosts or apparitions.
Hmm.
That's right, it was on my second birthday. I was sitting on the draining board in the kitchen, and there was all my friends there, and we were having a party. And I remember turning around and seeing a black man in a smart striped blazer with white trousers and a bow tie and a straw boater hat, very, very smartly dressed, standing in the corner of the kitchen. And, you know, I told my mum straight away, you know, that there was this this black man standing in the corner of the kitchen. Now, it wasn't until much later, years and years later, that I visited Horniman's Museum in southeast London. They had a special exhibition of voodoo, and they had a voodoo altar which was set up. And one of the displays was a mannequin dressed exactly the same as the apparition that I'd seen when I was 2 years old. And I'm not a great expert on voodoo, but as far as I understand it, this character is often invoked in voodoo rituals.
Yeah, I know there has been sort of mixed comments about voodoos. Mostly it's been associated with negative or sort of spells being put on people and that sort of thing, but I suppose that there's also a more positive aspect of voodoo. And I wondered if the experience you had was a positive, negative, or just a neutral one. Also, what your mum's response was when you told her about the experience.
Well, I can't actually remember what my mum's reaction was. Just the strongest memory I have of that birthday party is seeing that character standing in the corner of the kitchen. It's something that stayed with me. Voodoo is actually a form of shamanism. If you read the books by Mercier Eliade, the French author who travelled widely and studied the shamans of Siberia, shamanism in its most basic form is a form of earth magic. It's seeing divinity and spiritualism within the plants, flowers, trees, the clouds, the atmosphere, the sun, the moon. A shaman's view of the world is a world full of magical life energy. And this is the primordial basis of all of the great religions that developed thereafter. And voodoo is a form of shamanism. I mean, all forms of shamanism actually try to communicate with various spirits, most notably, usually spirits which are related to streams, rivers, forests. This is where we get the fairy folk tale or folklore, the tales of the Hans Christensen brothers. Iceland as well is a place that believes in fairies. There's even a government department that checks places where houses are going to be built to make sure that there aren't any fairy colonies there. And this is really all part of shamanism. And there's, since the 1950s, been a great boom in interest in earth magic, Wicca, paganism, and shamanism.
I know a number of people who are interested and in active in that, and myself included, really, although I haven't necessarily put a particular name to it, but I have always been a mystic and a clairvoyant and in touch with spirits, nature spirits, as well as entities on the other side. And so, of course, being a multiple near-death experiencer, this is really just enhanced all of this, and I really appreciate connecting with people who have been active in this, and we've also done a lot of research. Now, I found your film, Spirit World, to be quite brilliant. One thing I'm curious about is that it seems that there's been some negative experiences surrounding the Ouija board, but I would say that yes, indeed, people need to know what they're doing, but I don't think that it's always going to be a conduit of negative entities, but if one's the only entity centered in the light will enter in here, that people would ideally have a different experience. But have you, with most of your research and experience, has found the Ouija board to be a rather negative sort of device?
What I would say is that the Ouija board is opening a gateway. I mean, most weekier sessions just start with people setting up the board and then just asking, are there any spirits in this house? Well, that's opening up a gateway where any kind of astral entity can actually enter. And the difference between Ouija and Western ceremonial magic and the magic of the Hebrew tradition, which is most famously known as the Kabbalah, and also the magical traditions of the Orient, the difference there is that you've got a specific entity which you want to invoke in those rituals. And there is a wide variety of magical texts from ancient times. In France, they're known as grimoires. And these texts tell you how to invoke a specific spirit. And there is the difference between ceremonial magic and the Ouija board. The Ouija board is actually just opening up a gateway. And just because, you know, a spirit starts speaking to you, it doesn't necessarily mean that the spirit is always going to be truthful, because all spirits are just a continuation of the personality of a person. And if you've got a person who lies, then the spirit of that person could lie to you as well. So I think that, you know, there are great dangers with the Ouija board. There's, in actual fact, great dangers for your psychological well-being in all forms of magic. And the root of magic is actually spirit communication.
Well, you're making some really valid points here, and I appreciate that. And I know, too, I've had discussions with David Icke and other people, and we've discussed the fact that when, for example, someone has a near-death episode, where one goes and what one experiences is really determined by one's state of mind, how evolved the soul is, because there are different dimensions, as you well know, that people can go move into. And so some of them are lower astral plane dimensions, and then others are higher frequency dimensions, and so they are, there are going to be different experiences that people have. So I think your points are very, very valid ones, and people really need to know what they're doing and be conscious. I would like to ask you, what got you started in film production? Again, I really appreciate the work that you've been doing. What got you into the film production in the first place, and then also producing Spirit World?
Well, I used to work for EMI, which is a very, very large corporation. They run a record label business, and they had the Beatles signed to them. And I worked doing video, audio, post-production for various television shows. And then I started my own magazine that was about broadcast technology. This is more than 10 years ago. And basically, a very large publishing company bought the magazine from me. And I used money to invest into broadcasting on the internet. And I was the first person to broadcast video on the internet. And I started the Enigma channel, which broadcast documentaries 10 years ago. And it's the world's first global TV station broadcasting documentaries. And Enigma Motion Pictures is the organization which I started in order to make feature-length documentaries for cinema. And my first feature-length documentary was launched at the Cannes Film Festival in 2005. And that's the same year, the same festival, that Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 911, actually won the Palme d'Or. And my film, The Illuminati, which is now the world's first documentary series to go into four volumes. It's been shown all over the world. It's screened at late shows in cinemas all over the world. And I'm trying with my films to you know, show subjects which the normal mainstream media usually try to ridicule or just simply ignore.
Yes, and then even censor it and try to block that information from coming forward. And I really commend you for this work, because it's very important that it gets out here now. And as more and more people are awakening, there's a lot more opening up and interest in the truth. And it's vitally important that more and more people are able to have access to this wonderful information. So whilst we're talking about this, why don't you share with our listeners what your website is, so that people can access information about your films?
Yeah, there's actually a dedicated website that's full of press reviews and comments about my film, and that's www.spiritworlddvd.com. And there's also a listing with press comments and reviews of all my other films at www.enigmatv.com, which is the official website of the Enigma channel.
All right, and all of your films are featured on the Enigma TV website, correct?
Yes, yes they are.
Okay. Tell us a little more about what you cover in Spirit World.
Sorry, it broke up a little bit there. Could you just repeat the question?
Tell us a little bit more about what you cover in Spirit World, especially I noticed you were making comments that what a lot of us refer to as the shadow people are trying to keep this information away from us, the fact that we are multidimensional, the fact that we can and do connect with spirit in other dimensions. Tell us a bit about some of the things that you cover in this film.
Well, the film starts with 911. You know, there's been a lot of documentaries made about 911. There's lots of conspiracy websites dedicated to the events of September the 11th, 2001. I always wanted to make a film which focused on the spiritual holocaust and the spiritual aftermath of 911. And, you know, really basically Spirit World is the only feature-length documentary made for cinema on this subject in the entire world. It's the first film of its kind. And I think 911 was a good starting point, because there, within a very short space of time, you've got thousands of people going to their death in various shocking ways. And in the film, what I wanted to show is that, you know, it's a catastrophe on the physical plane, but if you can imagine in your mind's eye all those thousands of souls, the victims of the attacks of 911, all cascading into the astral planes and into the spirit world. I thought that was a good place to actually start the film.
Yes. And I noticed in it that you were indicating that a lot of these souls could be stuck even forever as a result of that sudden transition to the other side in a very catastrophic sort of way. Where do you come up with that conclusion, especially when I heard you say possibly forever?
Yeah, well, I read a hell of a lot of books, you know, during the research. The actual film has taken more than 7 years to put together. And I interviewed a doctor from Eastern Europe called Konstantin Korotkov, who's written a book called Light After Life. And what he did is he took electrical measurements from the fingers of patients in hospitals that actually died. And he kept charts of how the electrical energy, the actual natural electrical energy in the body, dissipated. And, you know, when somebody dies the spirit doesn't leave the body in a flash. It actually takes quite a long time to leave the body. And if you look at ancient texts, texts which have been compiled from interviewing people that have had near-death experiences, such as the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and there's also the Egyptian Book of the Dead as well. If you look at these ancient texts, you can see that, for example, the Tibetan Book of the Dead says that once the spirit leaves the body, it actually hangs around, and it actually is an opportunity for the person, the newly dead person, or the, you know, they're not actually dead, but the physical body is dead. The spirit leaves that body, is then able to hang around and watch the grieving process and visit the homes of relatives. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead generally teaches that this period can last for around 49 days. Now, let's just juxtapose the situation of 911. With somebody that's dying naturally after having a long and, you know, eventful and joyful life. A lot of traditions, you know, especially shaman traditions such as the, you know, the Cree, the Hopi, the Blackfoot, the Arapaho, the kind of natural tribes people of North America, Australia, and in Siberia, they have a whole preparation process for the elders of their communities when they're ready to die. And, you know, it's quite normal that relatives would visit and the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren would all gather, and the person would pass away in a peaceful, managed way, surrounded by loved ones. Now, let's compare that with somebody, a victim of 911, who boarded a plane, who had appointments, people to see, places to go, and in transit finds that the plane actually flies into a building and the spirit is ripped from their body in a most catastrophic and terrifying way. Well, my research suggested that, you know, a death like that, sudden, horrific death, actually shocks the spirit out of the body. And there is no preparation process. There is no opportunity to actually discuss death, the dying process. There's no opportunity to say goodbye to loved ones. And psychics that I spoke to who had done work in the Netherlands after a commercial jet airliner had crashed into a city in the Netherlands. This happened about 15 years ago. Psychics that visited that scene said that the streets were absolutely teeming with the spirits of the people that had been aboard the plane, because they died so suddenly and so horrifically that it took a long time for some of those spirits to even realize what had happened. Mm. And there are actually clairvoyant people who specialize in going to these types of places and working with relatives to try and put the spirits at rest and trying to help the spirits realize exactly what the situation is and asking the spirits if they would like to move on.
I've actually seen that too, where a lot of people don't even know that they're dead, quote, quote, that their bodies are dead. But one thing I wanted to say, again, as an experiencer, as well as a researcher, is that I've seen a lot of mixed or differing experiences take place. A lot of people do hover over their bodies on the sort of hang around them for quite a while, whilst others will pretty much straight away move on from their bodies. And so actually it's been quite mixed according to the experience and research that I've done. And that's why this is very interesting to me. And another point that I would like to make is that as souls, we know in advance when we're going to transition because of the sacred contract, as it were, that the soul makes before incarnating. So I've thought about that too, actually. It was really interesting because my daughter was in Manhattan during 9/11, and I didn't know what had happened to her because she told me, or I thought she told me, she was going to downtown, and actually she went to midtown Manhattan. The only thing I had to go on to assure me that she was all right was the telepathy between us. And I can't emphasize enough how very important that is to pay attention to and to trust in the telepathic experiences that we have. But anyway, with a lot of these souls that transitioned that day, I honestly got that some of them were prepared and knew in advance, even on a conscious level, something's going to happen. I'm getting ready to go. Whereas a lot of others probably indeed just didn't even know what happened to them. So, you know, this is a really, really good topic to discuss because, again, there's so much research going on. There's so many of us who have had multiple near-death experiences and some have even been to the morgue and all of that. You know, that we really enjoy comparing notes with other experiences and researchers. The funny thing with me is that during my near-death states, I did not hover around my body. It's almost as if I couldn't get away from it or far enough from it. So I moved way beyond the area where my body was. And then when I was told that I had to return to this plane, that's when I finally started to become aware of this physical body and then move back into it. So it's very interesting to note about all of this stuff. And also because of the healing work that I do, I have worked with deceased entities who are stuck and helping them to move on. Now, I would like to ask you what you feel about spirits who kind of hang out on the physical plane but are not necessarily stuck. They like to come around and visit friends and loved ones or places that they've been that meant a lot to them. And then they move back on again. What is your comment or feeling about that?
Well, there's a large part of my film, in spirit world, what I decided to do is dedicate about 20 minutes of screen time to the subject of mojos.
Mm.
Now, mojos, you know, I mean, that's a sort of term that's come from North American Indian shamans. But mojos are basically spirits of people who have died unhappy, and they are not satisfied with the life that they have had. And even after death, they still crave emotional interaction. They still crave sexual experiences. They crave to eat. They crave to drink. And, you know, a mojo is a lost spirit. And, you know, they go under many different names in many different cultures around the world. And it is most likely that, you know, you are going to come into contact with one of these lost, languishing spirits if you use the Ouija board. Now, what these spirits do is that they look and they search for people who are in a weakened psychic state. For example, somebody that's addicted to prescription tranquilizers will have a very low ebb within their kind of spiritual physique. And these lost spirits try to enter the body. And once that happens, we then get a classic case of spirit possession. And medically, this is often diagnosed as multiple personality disorder. And you get a competition arising in the psyche of the person And, you know, there are, let's say, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are undergoing medical attention in various institutions who claim that they hear voices in their head. And I believe that in many of these cases, this is due to a lost spirit who is still trying to experience the physical world, entering into a person who, you know, was in a vulnerable state. Now, in my film, I go on to say that I believe that teratoma tumors, which are these very, very large tumors that are sometimes cut out of people, are the result of spirits trying to hijack the genetic material in somebody's body and recreate a kind of physical body for the spirit to live in. And, you know, I learned about that kind of thing from reading lots and lots of books about earth magic and exorcism. Because, you know, exorcism is condoned by the... I've just come back from the Vatican and they actually train exorcists there. And the phenomenon of the spirit possessing a body and then manipulating the body and manipulating the personality of the person is widely recognized in most of the world's great religions.
Yeah, and I noted that was very, very interesting what you covered in that film. I don't know if you're familiar with the near-death experience of George Ritchie. He recently transitioned. It was over a year ago now, and he wrote the book called Return from Tomorrow. What was interesting is that he didn't know that he had died of pneumonia, and I also died of pneumonia too when I was younger. And he had wandered into a bar and saw the spirit of a man who was actually trying to use somebody in the bar to enjoy the alcohol and all of that kind of stuff. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Another common term for that is called spirit attachment.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then,
alcoholics, you know, they tend to have a mode in their lifestyle where they tend to drink alcohol in the cheapest bars. The most run-down sort of watering holes they can find in the back quarters of the back streets of cities. And it's these dirty, unkept places where these lost mojo spirits actually like to stay. And they actually take up residence above door frames, because the part of the astral body that these mojos enter through is through what's known as the crown chakra.
Yes.
The chakra system has been studied in Eastern mysticism for centuries and centuries, and it's through the crown chakra that these mojos try and penetrate the person's aura. So what they're really looking for is somebody that's inebriated, who's completely drunk, whose psychic and physical well-being is at a low ebb, and this is where they take their opportunity. And I mention in the film, somebody came along to one of my lectures with photographs of a door frame where you could see a kind of black crack, and this person said, you know, this is a spirit. And what alerted them to go there and take photographs is that they heard a talking. They'd heard the spirit talking previous night, and so they staked the room out, and they realized that the spirit wasn't a normal ghost. It looked like a kind of black crack above the door frame. And in a series of photographs, you could actually see this crack sort of moving. It didn't look anything more, you know, phenomenal than just a crack above the door frame. But, you know, it alerted me to the design of doors in ecclesiastical buildings throughout Europe and the Americas. You always have arched doorways And this is because the people that designed the great cathedrals, who were the Knights Templar, who were involved in magic and spirit communication by their own admission, they designed pointed and arched doorways to stop the mojos from actually taking up an appearance of a crack and being, you know, sort of overlooked by everybody and then dropping into the crown chakra as parishioners walk through the doorway.
I noted that too, and I thought that was rather interesting that somehow they too would be affected by gravity, as it were, because you referred to them as slipping or falling down off of these arched windows and doorways.
Mm.
But one thing, getting back to when you were addressing, you know, mental health institutions and people say, oh, do you hear voices, or the practitioners asking that, and then some people claiming they hear voices, and I would like to make the distinction or difference between that and people like myself as a medium. And I do hear voices, but it's not because I've got a spirit attachment, it's just because I'm communicating telepathically with other entities on other dimensions and even on this plane. And so there is a distinct difference in those two things. And yet for a number of years, really until this decade, I was very, very sort of in the closet about the fact that I'm a multiple near-death experience or the fact that I've had NDEs at all because of being grossly judged and misunderstood. And I've always been a clairvoyant and a mystic and had these communications, but again, there was the ridicule, the misunderstanding, people thinking, oh, you need psychiatric evaluation and all that nonsense. But that's why this kind of work is important, is to let people know that we do not just exist on a five-sensory third-dimensional realm, which really basically is nothing but a hologram, that there are other dimensions of reality on which we exist as spiritual beings. So I also want to focus on the positive aspects of spiritual on the other side, not just the mojos or the, you know, the ones who are trying, you know, who are lost, basically. There are also those who have been had very happy lives, but they just check in, as it were, to visit people and places that they've loved. I don't recall that you said a whole lot about that in the film, but what is your take on that, about the ones who've had positive lives but still like to check in?
That's partly the focus of the sequel to Spirit World, which is going to be released in about 6-7 weeks' time.
Oh, excellent.
I suppose the most common example of a spirit sort of calling back in to check on loved ones are the spirits of aborted children and the spirits of children, you know, that died in childhood. And I've done a lot of research for the sequel to Spirit World with parents that experienced the suicide of of their own children and the death of their children. And it's fascinating because in many cases, the children manifest their spirit messages through clairvoyance and also sometimes directly to the parents. They often come through in dreams, and then this sort of triggers a two-way conversation, if you like, between the parents and the spirit of the child. What I found interesting and fascinating in my research is that years and years later, a long, long after the death of the child, the spirit can still choose to be seen in the mind's eye of the parent as the child was when it died.
Yes.
And yet they tell the parents that they've actually grown up. They've grown up in the spirit world. In many cases of the children that have committed suicide, they've taken on jobs and full-time careers in the spirit world, actually helping newly arrived spirits of other children who've also committed suicide. You know, the same thing happens with the spirits of aborted children as well. They still continue to grow. And it's really just the, you know, it's just the physical body which is gone. And they grow up and they have childhoods and they grow to become adults. And for them, the astral planes, the astral world, the spirit world, whatever you want to call it, or heaven, or whatever your description is of it, is as real to them as the physical world is to us.
Oh, absolutely, and in fact, I would venture to say even more so. I felt a lot more real when I was not in my body as I do when I'm in it, and it still feels very strange to me to be in this body, and it's always felt strange to me all of my life. I just thought, this is really odd. I don't feel really at home in this. I feel like I'm strange in a strange land.
Yeah, well, one of the highest teachings of Buddhism is that the spirit world is actually referred to as true reality.
Yes.
And that the physical world is actually a place that is a dense sort of a place where we come here for growth in a dense environment, but the actual spirit world is considered to be the true nature of reality.
Well, that exactly has been my experience, and in fact, when I was looking into this plane from the other side, I could see it in the form of waves and particles. It didn't look solid at all. Also, it looked very drab in comparison to what I experienced on the other side, so it was really quite stunning when I was reading David Icke's book, Infinite Love is the Only Truth, Everything Else is Illusion, and I thought, oh, that's spot on. And he even had illustrations, photographs, as it were, of this very thing that I saw whilst on the other side. And he's a wonderful friend, so it's been really lovely comparing notes with him, because I said, oh, this is so spot on according to what I experienced, and the fact that this is a very low vibrational frequency, whereas the different planes of existence on the other side are higher vibrational frequencies. And of course, there isn't just two or three different dimensions, there's several. So it's like moving up the radio band. Every dimension is a different frequency. And so this is the sort of thing that we've brought up quite a bit. Now, one thing I would like to ask you about is what you're doing research on suicide that you're going to be including on your film, and I would like to have your comment about that, because I know that that's something that really, really concerns a lot of people. What is your take on suicide?
Psychological demeanor of a person who takes their own life is obviously pretty frayed at the edges, and you know, they come to the decision to commit suicide not lightly, and it's usually very sensitive people, very intelligent people that actually commit suicide in many cases, such as the parents that I've been speaking to for the research on the spirit world too, they told me that their children that committed suicide were, you know, very willing to take on the woes and the troubles and the stresses of other people. And they were often the types of children that would be often caught in deep thought. And when the parents asked them, what are you thinking about, they would be thinking about, you know, the big picture. They'd be thinking about, why am I who I am? Why am I here? And, you know, they would be the type of child that would not be so interested in, you know, on the surface TV shows and that kind of thing. They would be usually deep thinkers, they would be intelligent, they would be very, very sensitive. Now, the demeanor of a person like that in today's hydrocarbon society, extremely fragile, you'll see magical images, wizards, warlocks, witches, kings who have great magical powers, and lots of other kind of magical characters in nearly every single television show made for children. And when you have a very sensitive child who thinks about the big picture, who is maybe not really blessed with parents or a family that are spiritually advanced themselves, maybe they're living in a family where, you know, there are no books on the bookshelf. There is really no one to give them a bigger picture to help them, you know, along their spiritual sort of path. These types of children can be very affected because they begin to search for answers in television shows, which are obviously made as entertainment. And, you know, there's lots of people that claim that many television shows have got deliberate subliminal images in them designed to persuade you to do certain things, such as buy products. And a sensitive child can get lost in this miasma of product placement, magical images, and, you know, in a case like that, they can find no real spiritual sustenance in their school life. They don't really find anything really nurturing their interest in the bigger picture. Now, because they're deep thinkers and they're sensitive, they tend to spend quite a bit of time alone, and that can lead to them being singled out and bullied. And bullying is one of the biggest causes of suicide. So, taking in all of these factors, once a child or a person has taken their own life with their own hand, you are dealing with a particular type of spirit entering the spirit world. And over and over again, my research says that these spirits of these suicide children come through on seances. When the parents ask, you know, where are you, what's happened to you, the spirit of the child often says, well, do you know what, you know, when I arrived here, there was the spirit of my grandfather or my grandmother here, and they were here and they were waiting for me. And more often than not, the spirits of these children actually describe, you know, that they've got the spirits of their ancestors, their great-grandparents, their grandparents around them. And they've taken up a part of a spiritual community within the astral plane.
I think that is very interesting, too, because in fact, just a couple of days ago, I got an email from someone, and that's why my work is so important. It was someone who was saying, well, I'm not going to be here after this weekend. And I said, wait a minute. You can't really escape anything by taking the life of your body, because you still remain intact. Only, the only thing that you will lose is your body, but not your experiences. You will still need to deal with whatever you're dealing with.
I think a common theme to all of the messages from spirit children who committed suicide, a common theme that was running through all of these seances with the various parents that I've spoken to, is that the child bitterly, bitterly regrets having taken their own life. That there were spirit helpers there on the astral plane who had been trained, as it were, to meet the spirits of the suicide children and to work with them and to give them advice and to talk through things and try and resolve the predicament that led to the actual suicide in the first place.
Well, that's a really good point too, and I think that's why this work is so important, because when people can start to realize for certain that the only thing that is lost in so-called death is the body, not yourself, not your consciousness, not your identity, and even in many cases, not your circumstances. You're still going to have to deal with things. You're just moving into a different dimension, that's all. And so I appreciate that you're pointing out that these kids, for example, did regret having done that, because I give it the analogy of dropping out of school or dropping out of class. You're still going to have to go back to the beginning of the class and learn your lesson. You can't escape anything, really. So that's why this is also a very important topic to me, is to discuss suicide and to let people know that. And here, this is an older person. This wasn't even a child who sent me this email. It was an older person, closer to me in age, actually. And I had to remind this individual, you're not going to lose who you are. You're going to remain conscious. And it was sort of odd to me that he seemed to have forgotten all about that, because we've had long dialogues, again, since I'm a multiple NDE, who's described in detail about being on the other side. So I really appreciate this, that, you know, you're sharing about this. We're coming towards the end of this transmission of Toward the Light. Are there any events coming up, anything that you would like to share with us before we close the program for this hour?
Well, I'm going to be repeating a tour of the ancient sites in the south of France that are connected with the myth of the Holy Grail.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be doing that tour in the spring next year, and if people go to www.enigmatv.com, there will be information posted fairly soon about the mysteries of the Holy Grail tour. And I'm also organising a special visit to the house of Dr. Nostradamus in the south of France, which has been converted into a museum. And I'm organising a special long weekend for the spring of next year, where we visit the medical school where not only Nostradamus studied medicine, but at the same time Paracelsus is one of the greatest authorities on earth magic and talismans and pentacles, and wrote a great deal of materials about occult sciences. Paracelsus and Nostradamus both studied Montpellier on the Mediterranean coast in the south of France. I'm organising a long weekend tour to really discover the inner secrets of Paracelsus and Nostradamus next spring.
Oh, that sounds like it would be a really, really good tour that you're doing there. And when you've got the next additional volume too, I should say, of Spirit World coming out.
Yes.
And that's going to be in a few weeks, you said, correct?
That's right. It's going to come out in about 6 or 7 weeks' time. I actually start doing a tour of sites with a group of people who come here from all over the world tomorrow. That lasts for about 9 days, and then I go back to London for the post-production. There's a special orchestral score being composed for Spirit World 2. And there will be an announcement if you go to www.spiritworlddvd.com. You can stay in touch with us there, and there will be an announcement with the sequel within the next sort of 5 or 6 weeks.
I do want to say I really love the music that you've got in that, and being a composer musician myself, I really appreciate that. And also I'll let our listeners know that they can access your profile page on towardthelight.org at towardthelight.org/Chris Everard, everard.html. And also, when is the sequel to Secret Space coming out? That also is a very, very excellent film.
Yeah, well, my films about the Secret Space program are the most, they're the most successful films that have ever been made about secret space programs and NASA's research into extraterrestrial life. The first film came out in 2005, and then last year I interviewed Valery Uzurov from the Russian Space Agency and many UFO researchers about the evidence of astronauts from other planets visiting planet Earth in ancient times. And that was Secret Space 2, and that came out last summer. And we're now in pre-production for Secret Space 3, which will be released in the spring next year. And that features interviews with four NASA astronauts and two Russian cosmonauts who are all speaking about their UFO experiences on camera for the first time. There's actually a dedicated website with lots of press reviews and information. That's secretspacedvd.com. And again, you know, you can order the DVD there. And Secret Space 2 is actually 4 hours, and it's been released on a twin DVD set. And it's playing in late shows and in independent cinemas all around the world right now.
Well, it's a very excellent film. I was quite taken by it, and I appreciate the truth of this, because it was something that I had really felt myself to be true, and I appreciate all the fine work that you're doing, Chris. This is really, really tremendous. I want to thank you for being on Toward the Light, and we'll certainly have to have you back on to talk about more of this, maybe in a few months when some of this has come out and you can tell us about some of the interesting workshops and tours that you've conducted. So again, thank you so much, Chris, for being with us on this transmission of Toward the Light. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale reminding you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Next week, we're going to have Mr. Paul Elder on Toward the Light. He's a near-death experiencer and one who's done a lot of work with remote viewing and out-of-body research in conjunction with the Monroe Institute. So you'll definitely want to tune in next week. Please join us next week. And this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale signing off for this week. Please remember that only love prevails. We'll talk to you next week on another transmission of Toward the Light, leading back to the source. Blessings and light to all.